but I'd like to come out and talk to you about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. Went out, spent a day, we talked about it. And the upshot of that is that I decided, well, why settle for a single focusing mass spectrometer?
Mm-hmm.
Why not two double focusing mass spectrometers? And I, you know, understood in some detail, I thought, at that point in time, the Mittag-Herzog mm-hmm. geometry. Vannevar Johnson was a newcomer, to my understanding. And I thought I should probably visit Al Neer
mm-hmm.
before concluding
mm-hmm.
that that was the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
So again, a visit to Minnesota was no problem. And I met Al Neer. But he was getting old, Mike. He was kind of our age.
This would have been 1960.
Yeah, it would have been 1960, I guess. I think it was 1960.
Okay.
So anyhow, it was not as informative a discussion as I had thought might happen, but I met several other people in Minnesota who knew a lot about mass spectrometers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very good visit. And the net result is I still couldn't decide which would be the best pair.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, I'll take one of these and one of those. and ask CEC if they were prepared to bid on constructing such an instrument. And the answer was yes. And so they submitted a contract and so on, and eventually received a contract to build the tandem mass spectrometer. And it was delivered.
So what was where? You had the Mittag-Herzog in the front? And the
Mittag-Herzog was in the back.
Oh, it was in the back?
Yes.
Okay.
So what the people at CEC told me is they wanted to build a small-scale mass spectrometer for the front end.
Okay.
They asked me what kind of mass resolving power I wanted. After thinking deeply, I thought 300. So yes, they committed to build a double focusing instrument that could deliver resolving power 300.
Shouldn't be too hard.
Shouldn't be too hard. And they were going to operate it. I don't know why they decided on this number, but at 169 volts accelerating voltage. Okay?
169. Okay.
I do not know. I'm sure the world will never know why they settled on that. But that was the operating voltage. And the reason they did a low voltage, this is a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
How low can they get and still be confident that their design parameters are solid and so on? Because they knew I wanted to slow the ions down to thermal energies, okay? And they had me come up with a specification. I want to decelerate the ions, and I thought very deeply, and I said 1 electron volt, translational energy. And so this was it. A whole one-page list of all the specifications describing the first stage mass spectrometer, the second stage mass spectrometer, the collision cell, decelerating ions to 1 electron volt, and so on and so forth. And it was delivered. And it didn't work at all.
Now, did they do any pre-delivery testing at their end?
Or? Well, yes. They did quite a lot. So I'm quite sure they knew it wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And they had given up.
Mm.
They decided to deliver it. And
you asked for it, here it is.
Yes, here it is. And I learned something about procurement and legal dealings.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very important lesson. Because I demonstrated it wouldn't do bum, 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 bum. And they countered saying, yes, it does what you say in step one, in step two, step three, and so on, all the way to the bottom of the page.
You just can't do all those together.
Exactly, okay. And so the first stage mass spectrometer did operate at 169 volts, delivering an ion beam with a resolving power I think it was close to 500.
Yeah.
Exceeded specs.
Right, yeah, right. Sure.
Okay.
You're ahead of the game.
It could decelerate ions to zero. Nothing came through. Collision cell had differential pumping and met all my specifications.
Mm-hmm.
I left out the sentence, must perform all these functions simultaneously. So I had a collection of very interesting parts.
I guess, yes.
And, I entered into a desperate phase of my research, because this was the largest single investment.
Yeah, I was going to say this probably caused a piece of change.
Well, it did. I don't remember the exact number, but it was more than $200,000.
It was more than twice one mass spectrometer.
Oh, yes, it did. Yes. It was more than twice the price of a 21-110 bit. So we could do the math by working back in time. And so, to say the least, it was embarrassing to the lab director who had placed his confidence in me to do this. Tremendous disappointment to me. But we learned quite a bit about mass spectrometry up to that point, and we started learning about ion optics. Now, ion optics in those days did something interesting, an analog computer, I would call it. So there were a couple of ways of doing it. One of the more sophisticated one was take thin pieces of rubber, and you stretch the rubber to mimic the shape of the electric field.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put blocks of wood under it where the slits would be to distort the electric field. And then you start rolling marbles that simulates the ions coming out of your ion source. So we had tables set up all over the lab evaluating ion optical designs and so on.
Did you ever lose your marbles?
I did. Actually, my infant son stole my marbles and in the lab one afternoon. Took them home.
What did my dad do? Silent marbles.
Sent our research project. They actually paid me for this. And then there was conductive paper. I don't know whether you've ever seen this.
No, I haven't seen that.
Uniform carbon-coated paper that you would take conductive silver paint and paint your electrodes, and then you would take your voltmeter and measure. That's how you got your field plots.
Mm.
So anyhow, I spent several months doing this. Got nowhere in terms of how to solve the mass spectrometer problem.
I mean, you knew it should work, but it wasn't.
That's right.
Yeah.
But I discovered I had an electric sector and a magnetic sector. And so you can use those for energy selection and mass selection.
Mm-hmm.
What can you study with that? You can study metastable ions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I said, aha, we'll just investigate metastable ions in a double focusing mass spectrometer.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I have two of them that I can really study metastable ions. And so we started doing that. And that involved extending the absolute rate theory in the other direction to going to longer times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a place where another key person enters my life. His name is Marvin Vestal.
Oh, Crazy Marvin.
Crazy Marvin, yes. That's the one. So Marvin L., I think it's Leon Vestal, and you know how to spell it.
Yes.
He was an undergraduate at Purdue University.
Right.
And an entrepreneurial professor named Bill Johnston, J-O-H-N-S-T-O-N, had another person working for him named Henry Rosenstock. And somehow decided paying a call on me and talking about things they could do for me to help me to understand things I was doing. And Rosenstock was, of course, a magic word.
Yeah.
And so I said, yes!
Yeah.
So we'll develop a research contract to Professor Johnston at Purdue University to extend absolute rate theory in ways and means that I would specify as the person in charge of the project. And then Rosenstock left and got a real job at the Bureau of Standards.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the choice of either keeping this going or killing it, because I had written Rosenstock into my purchase requisition. And I decided to bet on Marvin Vestal as a person who could do that, because he seemed to be a really, really bright guy. Even though he didn't smoke cigars or have a white hair or a beard in those days, he was a really, really smart guy. And so I got connected with Marvin Vestal. Bill Johnston decided to leave Purdue and form his own company, Johnston Laboratories Incorporated, in Baltimore, Maryland. And I transferred the contract with him, and Marvin was helpful to me in my understanding of absolute rate theory and doing things, and we were co-authoring papers during that period of time. In the meantime, I completely bricked my pick trying to understand how to make the machine work for other purposes. And I make a critical visit by identifying the National Bureau of Standards, now NIST, as a place where the most sophisticated charged particle optics in the United States is being done. Later on, I got acquainted with the people in Europe who were doing it, and so on. And so I took my problem to the National Bureau of Standards. I took blueprints for critical part of the machine. By this time, I measured the properties of angles and everything else, kinetic energies, to a gnat's eyebrow for my primary ion beam. And I knew the characteristics of the metallic Hertzog from the place the normal electron impact ion source would fit. And so I took all this information with me to the Bureau of Standards. And Chris Couillat and Errol Simpson were the two science leads. Mainly they designed electron optics for advances in electron microscopes. That was one of the main activities that they did. But charged particles are charged particles. And so I spent an incredibly productive day. I think I signed up for 2 days, so it may have been a little more than a day. There, going over my problem, they got out all kinds of reference books. They took charts where they extrapolated them or transferred them to the board. Went way beyond the ranges where these relationships applied. And invented a new kind of electrostatic lens. And it goes something like this. It's the electric field gradient that influences the motion of charged particles. And what you would ideally like to have as a lens is an infinitely thin aperture or an infinitely thin slit, because then you don't have the finite length of this conductor as a minor perturbation of the optics. And so all the equations and so on refer to this infinitely thin object. But the brilliant idea they had is, suppose we have two field gradients, okay? So we deliberately make it a thick slit, all right?
Okay.
And we end up calling that a slot, okay? And so if you have a slot lens, then you have two field gradients, and then you can then sort of double the strength of your lens.
Okay,
so that was the concept. And then they did some corrections I never understood for the width of the of the slot and so on. The upshot of that is that within about 10 hours, had a design that would take this ion beam, put it into a tiny hole going into the collision cell, into my collision cell. And then they discarded the store-bought lenses for the metallic Hertzog and designed simple storebook lens that could be dropped in for that. And I thanked them profusely and took my notebook and went away, but not before I visited Rosenstock and Wallenstein and his colleagues at Bureau of Standards, and just say hello And by this time, they knew me. And what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm coming here to have the people in charged particle optics help me with a problem. And boy, I didn't say it quite that way. It was a little more vulgar than that. You guys are so lucky to have these people right across the street.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, who are they? And what do they do?
Yeah.
So anyhow, communication is difficult, and team research is still a great concept. It sometimes works.
Well, different buildings are great separators.
But it's hard. Anyway, at any rate, I came back, and then I had to have these things built, and they had to be the special metals and everything else to be suitable as lenses. And in the meantime, this summer, I had a distinguished visitor come from England whose name was Keith Jennings,
mm-hmm.
K.R. Jennings.
Mm-hmm.
And Keith had learned about me indirectly from his photochemistry friends and came over to the colonies, as he called it, to to begin to make the acquaintance of
the colonies.
some of the American mass spectrometry folks. And I was one, and I had the money.
Mm.
And so he could come for a three-month visit. So we essentially paid a summer salary kind of stipend for him to join us. And he came over. Great beginning of a friendship, continues to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm speaking at his 80th birthday
retirement
in December.
Oh, great.
In England.
Mm-hmm.
We just got our tickets.
Mm.
So anyhow, Keith was there, and he was just getting into mass spectrometry at the time, and he had a double focusing machine. And so I believe it was the first day, maybe the second day after the rigmarole of checking in had been finished, completed, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
As a foreign national,
mm-hmm.
as a let's say an ally during the Great War,
mm-hmm.
both Great Wars.
Mm-hmm.
It was more complicated than if he had been a Russian.
No, really.
I'll come back to that story in terms of Tal Rosa. But anyhow, Keith was checked in, and we're in the laboratory and starting to talk about science and so on, and showed him all the wonders, showed him the functioning 21-103, and this non-functioning in its intended format. I said, but in the meantime, we've learned how to use this.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've invented this decoupling of the two sectors so we can look at metastable ions.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the article that I've written. He says, oh, that's very interesting. And he reached in his briefcase, pulled out the article he had written.
Uh-huh.
Same invention,
uh-huh.
same idea,
uh-huh.
exactly, using the electric sector to energy select the ions,
mm-hmm.
and the invention of the, it was called the decoupling technique, or, sorry, defocusing technique. I always called it decoupling when I described it, because you didn't change the focus.
Mm.
You decoupled the electric and magnetic sectors for a different purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, we played around with that. We published a couple of papers together. And by this time, the lenses had been built and we could reconstruct that. Jennings had gone back to England and we installed this. And much to my delight, it worked.
Hmm.
So we were off and running. And we had learned enough optics that we had to do a number of things that had not been done for us in the machine that had been developed in California. So we had to put in an ion source that made a lot more ions.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to make a hotter ion source, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, increasing the number of electrons you shoot through and the aperture sizes, slits, actually. And then we discovered we lost so many ions throughout this long trajectory,
mm-hmm.
in that instrument. And so we put in added focusing elements.
Mm-hmm.
And let me see, would that be called Z-axis focusing? I've forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, you can increase the transmission efficiency of a double focusing machine by more than an order of magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
And since we had three sectors, we now had sort of three.
Mm-hmm.
So we needed three orders of magnitude more that had been given to us by mm-hmm. By industry. And so we put these added lenses throughout the system. And so we did a lot of things ourselves to make it actually work.
Mm-hmm.
And we put electron multipliers on the other end, and we did pulse counting of electron pulses, and I think we were the first people ever to do that on a mass analyzer, other than a few physicists who did special things.
Mm-hmm.
I know we were the first ones to put a multiplier on the Dempster machine, on the mm-hmm. 21103,
mm-hmm.
because we had to invent a way of getting the ion beam out of the magnetic field to have a multiplier work.
Mm-hmm.
And so by this time, I'd done enough reading. I knew if you put in a Veeam filter, mm-hmm. so you have an electric field that balances your magnetic field, and to get it through a field gradient, I had to build an electric field gradient that exactly matched the magnetic field gradient.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the ion beam would be extracted directly from the magnetic field. I could shoot it into a multiplier. And at one fell swoop, we increased the sensitivity of the old mass spectrometer by a factor of a million.
Mm-hmm.
Then we could do many more interesting experiments with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole series of papers where we use the old CEC machine to study very low energy ion molecule reactions and so on. And then the other one, we actually discovered we could decelerate down to 0.3 volts. And that had decreased the energy of an electrostatic lens by 1.5 orders of magnitude, by a factor of 50,
mm-hmm.
Compared to the best lens prior to that.
Mm.
And so it was really a remarkable lens. It entered the literature, not by us, but it became called a rectangular slit. Okay, rectangular slit lens, and was copied in quite a number of beam machines and other things. Never used commercially, to the best of my knowledge, except by us. So anyhow, we had the bear by the tail. We could do ion molecule reactions at the wazoo. So then,
let me ask: you did all this homebrew ion optic modification of the machine.
Yes.
So you had to have pretty good support in a shop somewhere.
Sure, we did.
This was,
we had to have excellent shops, and the key person was Dean Miller, who was my electronics guy,
mm-hmm.
okay? So he was a person who had been in the Air Force, worked as a civilian at Wright-Patterson, and I actually promoted him and got him to come to my lab from somewhere else at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And so it was his knowledge of electronics, how to do pulse counting. You know, without him, I would have been an asterisk somewhere. and the machine shop was first class, the glass shop was first class, all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I've known this all of my life, and so in my university careers, I always built up the shops
mm-hmm.
to enable faculty to do things that I could do, for example, mm-hmm. could not do without that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so he's a co-author on a number of these papers.
Oh, okay.
And it was heartbreaking to me I couldn't attract him to Salt Lake City.
Uh-huh.
When I moved out there. But at any rate, we were off and running, and it was like a rocket taking off, because we could do every experiment, and we could repeat and correct. I found out that was not a popular thing to do, correct errors in the literature.
Yeah.
Saying what I am to really do.
Yeah, well, you know.
Yeah, well, it's always disappointed me that scientists are people.
Yes.
There are distinguished names I can mention.
Yeah.
One I won't describe, but I stopped at Brookhaven to visit very outstanding people. And they had just completed a painstaking study in the old-fashioned way, a sequence of ion molecule reactions, you know. And so three big names in the business were involved in this as visitors and toilers in the vineyard to mm-hmm. do all this. And I'd given my invited talk, which seemed to annoy them rather than please them. And so I said, well, it'd take me 20 minutes to just check this out, see whether you're right. Mm-hmm. So I went home, and in 20 minutes I'd done it, and they weren't right. And so I sent them the graph. mm-hmm. I sent them a note, and I said, you might want to revise your paper. No. They didn't revise the paper. I think there were three incidents like this where I tried to help people. Mm-hmm. I guess I should put that in quotes.
Yeah.
And discovered to my amazement that they weren't at all pleased, and the note of co-authoring papers somehow didn't appeal to them when it represented different implications than the work had as the line of work that they were doing. And I even became known to editors to a few key journals because the short communications I wrote, first one I remember came back, I guess I won't identify the journal, says, there's nothing wrong technically with your paper. Well, one does not refer to one's colleagues using the kind of language that's in your paper. And I will not publish it unless you change it. That was another piece of very good advice. It ranks right up there with getting a house near the airport.
Yeah.
And nothing to do with science per se.
Yeah.
But very, very good human relations, useful advice to do that. So if you read a few of my papers carefully, you'll find footnotes that say, where I said in the text that this is in agreement with the authors, blah, blah, blah. But footnotes that says, the mass assignment was wrong in their paper. So it's really what I say it is.
No, okay.
And so on. So that's a far better way to present new information.
So to speak.
Yes. So
there's something else I'm curious about before we get too much further along, and that is, why did you come into the civilian side at such a high level compared to your, from G5 to G14? I see you had a PhD.
Sure.
And you had some experience.
It was simply because the lab commander, the person who had this West Point teaching experience, was totally on my side. He ended up, by the way, when he retired, he became professor at some state college in California. I've forgotten exactly where it was. Mm-hmm. So he went back to his academic beginning, so to speak, after he retired from the Air Force. His name was Eugene Mallory, and Mallory was important to my success at Wright-Patterson. And that's the other piece of the story I meant to mention, that part of my sort of instantly moving to the top, pretty much, as a civilian scientist, was a tragedy that Jean Dubois was killed in a plane crash. When I was launching my civilian career, there was lots of money. And then I suppose there was an administration change or something like that. All of a sudden there was no money. And so I was planning to go to the Pittsburgh conference back when it was held in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Wright-Patterson typically sent 300 or 400 people.
Oh, wow.
Something like that. A huge contingent because the Air Force Materials Laboratory was centered there. The Strategic Air Command was centered there. And then our fundamental science and the Air Force Institute of Technology had a graduate school operation. There at Wright-Patterson. So large contingency. But because of budget constraints, we had to decide. Both Gene and I could not go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been the previous year. And so he went to PITCON, Pittsburgh Conference,
mm-hmm.
in Pittsburgh. And then a plane load, pretty much, of Wright-Patterson scientists and engineers on the final leg of their approach to the civilian airport in Dayton, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Private plane had a head-on collision, mm-hmm. flew in the side of the plane, and killed everyone on board.
Mm-hmm.
And so something more than 80 people, close to 100 people,
wow.
from Wright-Patterson, senior engineers and scientists, mm-hmm. were killed. And I had the problem of going to tell his widow
mm-hmm.
About Jean Dubois' death.
Mm-hmm.
And this automatically made me the chief person in mm-hmm. kinetics, reaction kinetics, and mm-hmm. so responsible for that part of aerospace research laboratories, which meant I had to make more trips to Washington, D.C. and represent them in various places. And we actually had a review by the National Academy of Sciences, because we were doing so well scientifically. And so I had to, you know, present mm-hmm. our part of the program to a set of visitors, distinguished visitors. Three of them had been my professors at Berkeley, two Nobel laureates. And I was brash enough by then to invite them to go to the executive dining room,
because mm-hmm.
I was an executive,
mm-hmm.
and there was a dining room.
Mm-hmm.
Most people there spoke Yiddish, because they had been recruited from
oh, wow.
another culture
mm-hmm.
Besides mine. And then there was a German group that had been brought from Peenemünde and,
oh,
and those okay. places, okay? So one of the things, other things I turned down in the Air Force was a chance to be the right-hand person to Hans von Ohain, O-H-A-I-N. You can visit him at the Aerospace Museum in Washington, D.C., because he was the inventor of the jet engine in Nazi Germany.
Mm.
And he was the chief scientist of the Aerospace Research Laboratory. He was a civilian counterpart mm-hmm. to the Air Force commander. And he liked what I was doing, so he wanted me to be his personal assistant. And I decided I'd rather be my own person.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, had interesting conversations with him. I saw some interesting analytical problems for him.
Mm.
Absent my mass spectrometer, the supersonic Mach 20 wind tunnel that he cared intently about would never have worked.
Mm.
That's a gross exaggeration. Somebody else would have solved the problem.
He wanted a Mach 20 wind tunnel.
Yes, he did.
And this was weird for what?
And it was...
Within reentry or something.
Like that. Oh, yes, yes, yes. They had interesting problems. And I had a number of interesting experiences dealing with some of these questions. But to create Mach 20, you heat the air like crazy, pump it up to a high pressure, expand it into a high vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
So gigantic spherical vessels that someone I won't name, never identified, but he was one of my postdocs,
mm-hmm.
arranged with a crew to make a Halloween pumpkin once. So Wright-Patterson was on national news, our aerospace research lab Halloween pumpkin one year. I thought it was great fun, but you know, how a crew could get in and inside this fence and create this thing without anybody discovering it was not amusing to some
yeah.
people. So anyhow, I talked to the people in this review committee, and they were impressed. They said they were particularly impressed with what I was doing, the people that I represented, including some physics persons, and reported to me. And I said, so everything was good, right?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, yes and no. We'll include in our report that you're expensive. And so one could get more bang for the buck at a university. And you, young man, are smart enough that you should be at a university.
Oh, wow.
So that was fairly pointed advice.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, in the meantime, getting lots of inquiries and so on. So I decided to put the shingle up and see who saluted. So again, I was in the right place at the right time because universities were expanding. There was money. In fact, the year that I entered my academic career was the, if you look at the funding per capita graphs I have, that was the year that it peaked in the United States. And so my setup package, although very modest and actually reneged on, they never gave it to me, was immaterial because I had three research grants before I showed up for duty. So anyhow, things are going great guns. We got a very good report, but a mixed blessing, so to speak, from the review committee, and I was being tempted by several universities. The California system was expanding. Irvine was one I decided I might go to, University of California, Irvine.
Mm-hmm.
Also University of Utah, because that's where Henry Eyring and Absolute Rate Theory and Austin Barhoftig were.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly mass spectrometry and was not a dirty word there.
Mm-hmm.
And physical chemistry was the lead department there. And there were a couple of other schools that I was thinking about in a not too serious kind of way. And Ronald Reagan impacted on my career because he was elected governor. Not his first day in office, to pick a phrase from the current political
Yes.
But his first week in office, he canceled all the appointments of new faculty, senior faculty, at University of California campuses and all construction programs
Wow.
until the new administration could review and either endorse them or not.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I guess he was came in on this, let's get the budget under control.
Exactly, exactly. And so California was going bankrupt, something we've heard before. And it was all true, of course. But anyhow, I'm now on the University of California Irvine Advisory Board, but I had looked at the plans for the building that didn't get built for another 10 years. And I know the California system includes money for instruments, and my appointment, had it ever materialized, would have included two mass spectrometers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I settled for Utah. It was a great decision. I made a chart of reasons to do it and not do it, and it always came out wrong.
Yeah.
Don't go there. You know, there were questions, could I make it in a Mormon environment,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you know, would I be able to launch an academic career that would come anywhere close to competing with what was a going concern.
Yeah.
And by the way, the time-of-flight mass spectrometer that I bought had a had an ion source designed by Joe Franklin for them to do chemical ionization. And I had bought it, and the extra pumps and so on. And it didn't work either. So I had to learn more than I wanted to know about time-of-flight mass spectrometers. And I learned how to make it work, and this got me into a very close relationship with Bendix Corporation for time-of-flight mass spectrometers. And so anyhow, I was leaving a lot of things behind. You know, a lot of unknowns, uncertainties. But intuitively, I knew it was what I wanted to do. I wanted to move back to the West. It was not California, but it was getting back in the West. That had some appeal to me. Having met Henry Eyring and some of his people, being keenly interested in that theoretical framework and doing experiments that relate directly to those theoretical predictions, all seemed to suggest that it made sense to do that. And so I decided to make the jump and become an experimentalist, working on some of the central themes of the sort of Eyring, Barhoftig, and other folks, Calvin Giddings, gas chromatography, some really good people that they had. And I was the start of the new expansion of the University of Utah, where they had resolved, for whatever reason, to stop hiring Mormons.
So that was primarily a Mormon institute.
So their new president, a Mormon president, had been the head of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Okay.
So a physicist. And so he was the new president of the university. He had completely new ideas, okay? He wanted to stop bringing people because you can bring them home to the church. He wanted to hire the very best people you could find. And he'd done the math because, of course, he knew how his university, when he was at Jet Propulsion Lab, how Caltech works. And he wanted Utah to be kind of reconstructed in that philosophical framework. And so he said, you hire the best people. I don't care what they cost. Hire the best people. And I want them to be doing something that's of current scientific interest. And I can do the math and I can explain it to the legislature and everyone else, that someone who comes in and is funded to do research will bring in the students, that will build the reputation of the university, and every dollar brought in from federal sources will be spent at least five times. And so, you know, they will be providing revenues to the state of Utah, and I can persuade them to put these funds into the state university. Well, that was the hang-up. That's the hard part, is convincing them to do the final step of investing in the in the state university. But anyhow, that was his mantra. And so I was kind of swept in that time frame. And as I said, I had three funded research grants by the time I showed up.
Yeah,
I went from Wright-Patterson to Berkeley. To have a crash course in learning to be a professor.
So how did that work out?
Well, it was fun. It was great fun to be there and to visit with people. I was sort of reminded how much I did learn from various people, teaching skills, and the ones that I liked. George Pimentel was one that I liked a lot. And George Pimentel was of interest and helped me later, when he's presidential science advisor and things like that. But anyhow, it was an environment that was different from Utah. But I had in my imagination that it was going to be the same kind of school.
That was the objective.
That was the objective. Okay. And I already had the money to buy ion cyclotron resonance spectrometer, and the president of the university thought I was getting a cyclotron. He was a physicist, so he brought over a couple of his cronies from the National Academy to see my cyclotron when I was on board. And whatever. And so, you know, he didn't really know what I did, at least not at first. But that's how, and I read some very advanced textbooks that were used at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I assume students had learned a lot since I was a student. And that's the story behind the ridiculously low grades, mm-hmm. the first exam that I gave. But, again, I do what I always do. I confront my problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told the class afterwards, I said, this didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
This simply did not work. And so obviously, my assumptions that you were reading and understanding a textbook,
mm-hmm.
and that I could, and that if I ask if you had any questions, you would ask them,
mm-hmm.
is not correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so my lectures have been starting at the wrong level. And so I'd like to come to your level if it's not coming down too far, mm-hmm. and I'd like you to come up to mine.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the next month or so, maybe 2 or 3 months, I don't know, however long it takes, I'm going to come here every evening for 3 days of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll stay here as long as anybody is interested in asking questions and talking about what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also going to have all the TAs attending my lecture. They're going to sit here in the same room so they know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have a special session with them to make sure they understand what I'm saying before they are assigned as your teachers, as intermediaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to do a better job, folks. So, and fortunately, as before, we had all the, social media ratings of teachers. Otherwise, I would have been fired. As it was, I was promoted to full professor at 32,000 feet. I was on a trip back east to ask for more money,
uh-huh.
and the faculty thought I was doing pretty well.
Uh-huh.
So I moved up from associate professor untenured to full professor with tenure. And that happened in the first 4 months, I guess.
Oh, boy.
That I was at the University of Utah.
Oh, okay.
So it was a meteoric launch. I didn't get to bring anybody or, the tandem mass spectrometer or anything
mm-hmm.
out with me. What I got as my dowry was an offer of enough money to buy an oscilloscope and also access for 1 day per week to the departmental Mataut-Herzog
mm-hmm.
mass spectrometer. Well, so that's what I started out with as my instrumentation
mm-hmm.
at the University of Utah.
Mm-hmm.
But within the first 4 months, I got funded to buy the magnets, buy one commercial Styrotron ICR, and buy two magnets for building my own versions
mm-hmm.
of cyclotron resonance mass spectrometers. And I guess in the second year, money for a time of flight. And so we were equipment wealthy within the second year.
Mm-hmm.
Starting things out. But the first year I had the 21110B mass spectrometer, and I knew I could study metastable ions, so I decided to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
Decided to investigate collision-induced dissociation of ions. So what would you expect me to do? Based on the story so far, well, I'll save you asking the question, I'll tell you what I did.
Mm-hmm.
I installed a differentially pumped collision cell. I put in differential manometer to measure the pressure in the collision cell. I put ion optics ahead of that cell and after that cell so I could make sure all the ions went in and that I could scan the angles and integrate and get all the ions that came out.
Mm-hmm.
So I did the complete collision-induced dissociation experiment. And I was the third person to do it. some guy, maybe you've heard of him, Fred McLafferty?
Oh, yeah, I know Fred.
Do you know Fred?
I know Fred.
Yeah, Fred McLafferty. Conventional wisdom is that he discovered collision-induced dissociation of ions, and that was just an extension of the ordinary mass spectrum, where you re-excite the ions, then they decompose. And he did that. I think it may have been Frank Turecek, I'm not sure, which postdoc co-authored the paper. Frank's now at the University of Washington. But they did it by loosening a bolt.
Yeah.
So they let laboratory air in.
Yeah.
To induce a dissociation.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Meantime, across the pond, my new bosom buddy and friend, I mean, I'm the colonialist, and he's from the UK, Keith Jennings, just put the bake-out heaters on and baked off whatever crap it accumulated during the week. And that's why the world thinks he discovered collision-induced dissociation. And I did it correctly.
Okay. You actually introduced the gas.
That's right. And because I introduced the gas, I knew what the gas was. I knew the cross-sections. And I could scan the ions and get the whole spectrum, and I could show quantitatively that it was just a re-excitation of ions, and the absolute rate theory does describe what's going on. But by the time that paper was written, nobody was excited about CID anymore.
Yeah.
And so anyhow, I did it my way. And that's, you know, just a different approach to doing it. So more fundamental, I guess, rather than discovery science.
Yeah. Kind of thing. Pre-planned or with a little bit of thought, forethought.
Yeah. You know, I have utmost admiration for discovery science. And nothing pleases me more when something works out wrong. Because if you look at a recurring theme in my life story, it's things went wrong and I somehow had to fix it and discover an interesting key to what was going on. So the other thing that we did on that one, and we're funded to do, actually by industry, this time by CEC, which certainly was Bell and Howell.
Yeah.
By that time, was to put chemical ionization onto the Metalkreutzer 21-110.
Mm-hmm.
Now, more or less at the same time, Austin Verhoftig and I had become consultants to Marvin Vestal's company.
Uh-huh.
So it was Johnson Labs Incorporated initially.
Yeah.
And then it was reborn with a different name.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things Marvin did, earned a fair amount of money, was putting chemical ionization onto anybody's mass spectrometer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what he was doing. And Austin was a tremendously knowledgeable, smart person. Both of us were consultants to Marvin's company.
Mm-hmm.
So we stayed engaged and working with him, and I knew how to do it for my own mass spectrometer, and key problems for putting it on a high voltage ion source is electric discharges, and something called the Paschen-Bach curve. I don't know whether you've heard of it or not, but if you look at the minimum voltage it takes to strike an electric discharge, turns out to be awfully close to one torr pressure, which is kind of a semi-standard operating pressure for a chemical ionization ion source. And so, like it or not, you're in the region where ion sources are easiest to establish and hardest to get rid of. And so I have a photograph that I'll show you later that shows what we did. We did a spark suppressor by putting a series of glass encapsulated resistors. I knew this from having taken apart quite a number of electron multipliers by then. So get the same resistors. You can build up a resistor chain with gold-plated mesh in between. And so you establish a field gradient that moves you up the Paschenbach curve and also down in voltage, modestly up the curve and down in voltage. And so you can completely suppress the electric discharge.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have to put your gas source a little over a meter further away from the ion source to make it work. So anyhow, we did that. And it was funded by industry, and the people who were interested came to see it. They were interested in learning how to do it. And they were totally convinced it wouldn't be interesting. So it would, and I didn't think it would be very sensitive either. I never patented tandem mass spectrometry or ion molecule reactions in any sense. Frank Field did. Field and Franklin, I think. Not sure. Anyhow, Frank Field, the chemical ionization patent. Simply because you lost so many ions in going through a complex path and extracting only small fractions here, there, and everywhere. So it was not a sensitive thing, but boy, do you reduce the noise. As long as you reduce the noise by orders of magnitude more, then you reduce the signal.
Oh, yeah.
And you have a signal. Then you have an analytical technique that works. So anyhow, the people from Bell and Howell, formerly CEC, brought test samples. They were then doing surface ionization as a competing technique, so to speak. And they brought some of the same samples, and we introduced them. And it took 2 or 3 days to pump the stuff out so we could run a second sample.
Ah.
And so chemical ionization is incredibly sensitive ion source.
Yeah.
And it never occurred to me that that would be true. You know, we were using it without thinking about it or comparing it really to electron impact source or anything else.
Yeah.
And so the reason it is so sensitive is that if you have a higher pressure in the source, you're stopping more of the electrons. You're making more ions to start with. Secondly, ion molecule reactions give you a product ion at every collision. And so your cross-section is huge for making ions, and so you convert many more electrons into ions ultimately that you can use analytically. And so it's obvious when you describe it, but we had never thought about it up to that point in time. But then Marvin's company was very interested. Hey, you can make very sensitive ion sources for mass spectrometers and so on. And so they did that. And then, very much to my surprise and delight, after we were building all sorts of toys at the University of Utah, Marvin sold his shares in the company. I think the company was sold in its entirety. And he had enough money to complete his PhD anywhere that he wished. And he chose to move to Salt Lake City and do his PhD at the University of Utah.
No, there you go.
And by this time, I knew what needed to be done. So we created the interdisciplinary degree in chemical physics. So that someone who was primarily a physicist and a theoretician in terms of his published works would meet the criteria for that graduate program. And so I believe Marvin was the first PhD in chemical physics. I do know I created that program, interdisciplinary program at the university, and several more of my students got degrees in that. And so Marvin joined us, and we did all kinds of wild and interesting things because the notion something is impossible, just not in his lexicon, willing to tackle anything. we decided, hell, let's go for broke. We know I need ions to do the experiments I want to do. I'm interested in in ion molecule product ions, let us build the ultimate sensitivity chemical ionization source.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? How would we do that? Well, Marvin and I totally agreed. You take every parameter and increase by 10, okay? So you increase the energy of the electron by 10. Not quite all. We increase the pressure by a factor of 10, and so on and so forth. We increase the size of the ion source so we can make sure every ion reacts.
Mm-hmm.
Whang the on button. Wait expectantly with the electrometer. Nothing. What comes out? Nothing. Okay? We check everything, you know. Everything is wired up perfectly. We decide to put voltage on the repeller and measure ion current there inside mm-hmm. the source. Lots of ions. Some point as we increase the current, well, we know when the discharge is initiated.
Yeah.
That's clearly a clue, and we don't wish to do that. So ions are not there. They don't get out. Well, let's rethink this.
So you're making them, but they were stuck.
Yes. What is the normal state of matter? Neutral. What happens if you make ions and you have enough ions that the electrons are all stopped in space? Well, they recombine. What happens when they recombine? They're neutral. They don't get out. Well, so that's not the way you build it. You don't want to build an equilibrium source.
Yeah.
You want to build a non-equilibrium source for chemical ionization. We had acquired, by this time, a CH7.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Mass spectrometer. Okay. Marvin and I decided to make CH7 plus. Why not? It would be really neat. Observation in
CH7 plus ion or CH7 plus mass spectrometer?
Well, both. It's going to be CH7 plus ion observed in a CH7 mass spectrometer. So, we built a source. We chilled it down to liquid nitrogen temperature.
These are all experiments that never worked, I guess.
Right. And we never got CH7.
But you had fun.
We had fun. Got a lot of interesting, weird results. And I used the CH7 to publish the only paper the first paper and one of the very few papers that I published on sequencing of peptides. And I was the first person to do it by chemical ionization mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
So you do a proton transfer, probably to the amino terminus of a peptide, and you choose a reagent ion that's energetic enough that you can break the bonds. And you can start with low energy. You can see the intact ion, then more energetic, lower proton affinity reagent mm-hmm. gas, mm-hmm. and break it. And that was, one of the international conferences. I was giving a talk on ion molecule reactions, and suddenly special oral lecture to talk about doing that. And I think it was in Brussels meeting. So I was talking to biologists, and I had a student who was interested in doing that. Would have pursued it, except the student lost interest and went somewhere else. So in academia, that's what I learned. If you don't have a student who is sufficiently interested mm-hmm. to do problem, do experiments and
mm-hmm.
fail to work over and over again, then you're probably not going to succeed in doing that. So we did the MS 30, which was a mm-hmm. parallel beam mm-hmm. oddity mass spectrometer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we built a chemical ionization source for one beam and the electron impact source for the other. And so we had our calibration spectrum
mm-hmm.
on one side and the chemical ionization spectrum, whatever it was, on the other side. We could leak samples into both sources and get those results.
Simultaneously.
So that was kind of interesting. It was obvious that putting a computer on the mass spectrometer was an interesting and important thing to do. I made a mistake of deploying too many resources to do something that was obvious that other people would work on.
Mm-hmm.
But we were among the first, maybe the first, to actually put a computer on a quadrupole mass filter, mass spectrometer.
Mm-hmm.
I got involved with Bob Finnegan, who, when he was at SRI before he branched off to form his own company, and I actually had acquired two quadrupoles, one at Wright-Patterson and one at Utah, from Finnegan when they were still made at Stanford Research Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a number of experiments with this. We had another person who joined us. IBM bought a laboratory computer, and I've forgotten what they called it.
Was this when they were trying to break into the analytical
instruments? They were trying to break into analytical instruments, and so they built this laboratory computer, and we used it to interface and do the quadrupole. That was the simplest because we knew the theoretical peak shape and so on. You only needed a fraction of the peak to assign the mass.
Mm-hmm.
And then we could calculate the area from a few data points. So we did that successfully. And we actually interfaced a magnetic sector machine based on a bizarre idea. And so the idea was to sweep the electric field. Of course, you're sweeping that when you sweep the mass spectrometer. And so one of my postdocs, wives, put a wire on a bobbin from a sewing machine.
Mm-hmm.
I inserted it in the magnetic field, and we measured the voltage developed when it was scanning.
Hmm.
And then by running calibration samples, we could, and setting our voltage scans to be identical, we succeeded in doing that. It was not the most brilliant idea, but it was fun, and we did it, and we improved on it, and we presented probably a poster at ASMS. I think you were with me when we invented poster sessions in ASMS.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Back then.
Way back then.
Well, oh, yes.
So anyhow, we were doing some of those things. Among several things that we proposed to the funding agencies that they decided they would not fund, was a triple quadrupole mass spectrometer. And we were going to do photoionization of ions.
Mm-hmm.
So we were going to mass select an ion, put it in the intermediate quadrupole, and photodissociate it. And then the third quadrupole was going to tell us what we had done. So it was another tandem mass spectrometer that we were doing. And we asked for money, and their wisdom or lack thereof, we didn't get it. But I had...
Where'd you go to for ask for money?
I think it was the NSF, probably, that we asked for money. And, you know, it got some good reviews, but it didn't get enough outstanding reviews, etc. And we had, you know, significant funding anyway. So I suspect there's an element of they've got theirs and, you know, maybe too much funding. I don't know. Speculation. At any rate, had a student whose father and uncle had a machine shop.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that they had a really good machine shop.
Mm-hmm.
And so at zero cost to me and the government, the machine shop run by his father and uncle manufactured quadrupole rods for us. And I think they made 24 rods. They ground them, you know, sort of following the instructions.
Mm-hmm.
I had done a sabbatical by this time at Boulder, Colorado, at Gila. They used a lot of quadrupoles. They had their own electronics for that, and so we got the NIST circuit diagram and some spare parts from them to build our operating electronics for that. And we built the first triple quadrupole, and it actually worked. And we published a paper. We had an awful lot of noise in that, and so our signal to noise was not great for the photo dissociation experiment. So my thought was, use that for MSMS. That's what it was doing anyway.
Yeah.
And we were putting a small photo signal on top. But we were doing lots of other things, and so so we were also making biomolecular ions. We were working with Jim McCloskey. You remember how to spell Jim McCloskey? He had been persuaded to join the University of Utah. He had a nice suite of instrumentation, and we had NIH grants that he and I, Barhoftig, I've forgotten whether Marvin was on it as a PI or not, but he certainly was key to making any of this stuff work. And it scored very high, but it wasn't funded in that go-around. And so we sort of scraped by for a year doing experiments with our own resources, so to speak. And we were going to make ions from from high-pressure chromatography. This is Cal Ginning's operation. And so very high pressure, essentially CO2 in the liquid state.
There's a phrase for that.
Supercritical.
Yeah, supercritical
fluid.
Yeah, chromatography. Yeah.
Yes. And so that was one of the things we were going to do. Use that for separating these biomolecular ions. And then we automatically have the enthalpy to evaporate everything. And so all we needed to do was to ionize the ions, as if that were easy. And then there was a liquid chromatography version where I was going to use ultrasonic waves to put in heat energy to knock all of these unpleasant solvent molecules off. I discovered accidentally that there's a company in Salt Lake City that made the sonar resonators for the Navy. So, man, we were able to put energy in. So we were going to do that as another ionization method. And then the other one is we were going to do liquid chromatography and then use a very intense laser beam to strip off the solvents as they came out of the nozzle. So those were the things that were in play that we had proposed and got a very high marks from the NIH, but no money. And I think I got a small grant, sort of, I've forgotten what they call it, Pioneer Grant, I think, to try out an idea. And so we were working on this ultrasonic excitation thing to make ions. And sort of in this year where we're doing those experiments, we had some successes, but we didn't get far enough to publish a comprehensive set of papers on that. And then Marvin couldn't wait any longer, so he was getting job offers, and he left to go to the University of Houston. And so we sort of split up the spoils, things that he'd been very much involved in, took with him. And one of those was the triple quadrupole. And he would have gotten a lot more credit. I might have gotten more credit, but he would have gotten a lot more credit had he not had such exceptional success with thermospray mass spectrometry.
Yeah.
Okay? So we were still very much collaborators. So he took that with him, took a lot of spare parts, electronics, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Without Marvin there, kind of lost interest. And let's see, McCloskey was a good collaborator, provided Marvin was in the loop.
I see.
But with Jim McCloskey, he believed in store-bought instruments. And so in real emergencies, when he had a machine that was working, we had to get a paper for ASMS or something.
Mm-hmm.
More than once, he would loan me one of his instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd find something that you could do better. And I would announce with great pleasure, "I've increased your sensitivity by a power 10
mm-hmm.
or something." And I'd walk away feeling good, and he would thank me for it. And then he would tell his technician or student, "Go get that circuit out of here. Get it back the way it was."
Yeah.
And we'll drive on. And so, you know, the McClafferty partnership, sorry, my misspoke, of course, McCloskey.
Mm-hmm.
McClafferty's not that way at all.
Mm-hmm.
McCloskey partnership to do biomedical mass spectrometry then evaporated. He and Marvin worked together for sort of the completion of that grant.
Yeah.
And the machine was installed in McCloskey's lab. I continued to be involved in it. The thing that I didn't agree to, was disappointed by, is that the postdoc, key postdoc, Calvin Blakely,
mm-hmm.
Calvin Blakley, who was willing to do almost anything that Marvin and I thought could be done, he gave it a very serious try.
Mm-hmm.
And he was good enough that he was successful more often than not. So it was heartbreaking when he told me he was going to Marvin.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to him last week. He has a few photographs that he sent me for the interview. And he was Marvin's right-hand man at the University of Houston. And, you know, he said that was exciting. When Marvin left, it wasn't nearly as much fun. But he stayed there. And he is retired, of course, a number of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he's enjoying life. So he's enjoying life more than he did sort of the last 15 years of his career. But anyhow, he was a key part of the team as well to make mm-hmm. all these things work.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down to visit Marvin, see what was going on, kick the tires, mm-hmm. so to speak. When they had declared victory, it was working. And what was supposed to work is that you have the separation going on, and then at the very tip, then the intense laser beam vaporizes the solvent molecules.
Mm-hmm.
You choose a laser wavelength so the solvent absorbs.
Mm-hmm.
That was what the research grant
mm-hmm.
called for. That was the theme. Well, how do you see this intense laser? I think it was a CO2 laser, and I'm not sure anymore. You can't see it. It's invisible.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way they tracked the laser as they brought it up to the tip is that they welded wires sticking into the vacuum chamber, and you would burn them off as you got closer and closer to the right position.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, you know, we hadn't thought about that
mm-hmm.
in writing the grant, and so that's a problem. That was their solution, and they were showing it to me, but the wires were all burned off by now.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were actually hitting the tip. So they now knew they had the laser in the right spot when the tip was glowing cherry red. Okay? So I said, "You are not doing laser dissociation of a solvent."
No.
Thus was born thermospray.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And Marvin benefited a lot from that, exploited it, came up with a number of creative ways other than lasers to heat that. The most creative that I ever saw, delivered to McCloskey, and then replaced,
mm-hmm.
was having oxygen and hydrogen torch.
Mm-hmm.
So a very hot torch inside the vacuum mm-hmm. system, heating the tip of the capillary.
Mm-hmm.
And then putting very intense electrical heat was, you know, the heart of the commercial version, the eventually emerged. Except for John Finn, mm-hmm. and except for Electrospray, that would be
the way it went.
Much more famous
yeah.
way of ionizing things.
Yeah.
Because now, we're finally understanding any way of stripping solvent molecules off will generate ions.
Mm-hmm.
Just as we said, kind of, in our proposal.
Mm-hmm.
It's not ionizing them, it's stripping off the solvent
mm-hmm.
Without changing the charge states and destroying the molecules is critical.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were on the verge of an important discovery, and you know, if the NIH had come through, who knows?
Yes.
Who knows? But anyhow, that did not work. But there were other things that came along. Agent Orange. I remember that was a different military conflict.
Yes.
And still around as an environmental contaminant in some places. Quite a number of my graduate students have made careers of telling people where Agent Orange is.
Really?
Or other interesting yeah. environmental contaminants
yeah.
by doing analytical chemistry. But after this was discovered at MIT, I believe, maybe Harvard was also involved in the team, there was a problem. The detection limit was very close to the toxic limit, the LD50.
Oh, yeah, which great.
Half the animals died.
Yeah.
And so by the time you could detect it, it was too late already. So there was a rush on involved the EPA. And I was well known to the EPA because, sort of in a different context, I'd been involved in the federal advisory apparatus. I chaired the Senate Technical Advisory Committee for the Senate on Public Works when the Environmental Protection Agency was formed, I think in 1970, thereabouts.
I think so.
And so I was involved in giving them technical advice, you know, for a couple of years before that happened. They started flying me around in first class to interesting parts of the world.
That's nice.
And it was nice. It was extremely interesting to do that. We had high-level meetings with senators I got to know.
This is still wired here at Utah?
Yeah, still at Utah.
Okay.
At Utah, they call me the political scientist because I was off doing this kind of thing. And John Baldeschwiller was the other end of the street in the Nixon administration.
Uh-huh.
And he ended up being presidential science advisor for a short term, when I was at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue.
Uh-huh.
And it was a source of some consternation and total amazement that he and I would go to lunch and talk about science. How can you do this? This is the enemy. I said, no, he's not. He's a Republican, that's
yeah,
all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so John helped me to get answers very quickly to a number of interesting, vexing questions and so on. And so EPA got started, and you know, in the original legislature, it was to have its own research labs and
mm-hmm.
patterns sort of after NIST.
Yeah.
Because again, understanding what is a pollutant in the environment is not easy. And discovering what it is that's causing what problem.
Yeah.
And so on. And so it was a source of disappointment to me that it evolved into more of a regulatory
yeah.
agency over time. But anyhow, it was exciting to be involved in starting that. And so I was a well-known quantity to the EPA when this problem came up. And so they invited me and several other people, one of whom was Tom Tiernan,
mm-hmm.
who had in the meantime become a professor at Wright State University. He had succeeded in taking all the toys he inherited from me
mm-hmm.
across the street to the Wright State University campus that had joined Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was an important person in that. And there were several people, and Dow Chemical was a lead industrial laboratory. And so the challenge was to increase the sensitivity by a factor of 1,000.
For
detecting CCDD.
Ah.
Okay? Because then you'd be well below the toxic range and you could detect it at low levels,
yeah.
Detect it in the environment,
yeah.
All kinds of things.
You didn't want to detect it as it was killing you.
No. No. You could probably do that. Not of interest. So anyhow, with all the games we had played with mass spectrometry, it's no problem.
Yeah.
You put in some optics to squeeze your ion beam, and we did it on the MS-30.
Mm.
We actually scanned the electric sector, and we could do it fast enough with modern electronics that the instrument wouldn't realize that you were sweeping the sector. And so we could scan over the definitive experiment. That is, they would actually synthesize for us the labeled molecule.
Mm-hmm.
So it's labeled with C13. I think it may have been labeled with oxygen as well. It may have been double labeled, but it's C13. And so you could see the characteristic chlorine isotopes, and then you could see them shifted to the isotopic one.
Mm-hmm.
And so the final experiment to prove you were successful was quite straightforward. But to get there, you had to increase the sensitivity. And so we knew various tricks for putting in optics, and we knew that we could sweep it fast, and therefore mm-hmm. we could look at the isotopes and determine all this had happened when the gas chromatic peak had mm-hmm. come out.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything was happening in real time. And so we succeeded in doing that. In the course of the way, we had to learn about extracting dioxin from unpleasant samples and things like that. And so I had labs that were under lock and key and postdocs only
mm-hmm.
working in there, so no one would be exposed
mm-hmm.
except me and them. And hopefully not fatally exposed, obviously not in my case.
Mm-hmm.
And so every time we made progress, we found out that Dow already knew that. That was a pattern for some period of time.
Mm.
These people are good. Mm-hmm. They knew the mass spectrometry very well. But then the big leap to increase the sensitivity once we had the sample selection, they didn't know. And so we succeeded in doing that, and then I was invited to D.C. to provide testimony to the Senate showing the first sample of TCD in the belly fat of a Vietnam veteran.
Mm.
And so that was a well-attended one. And I was asked to leave the original records. And you've never seen that publication because the original records vanished. The program officer in charge of the project disappeared as he found a government job elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the records I've been required to leave with him got lost.
Mm.
And my funding was cut to zero.
Mm.
Just coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
Just coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, I got even with the EPA. I felt good about our success mm-hmm. in doing that. And I decided I would never send them a research grant again.
Mm-hmm.
And I've maintained that to this very day.
Well, you know.
So anyhow, there were several other things that we did. I got sort of involved, intrigued by some, let's say, practical side
mm-hmm.
experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And got involved in the NSF-funded center at Utah called the Flammability Research Center.
Mm-hmm.
This drop-off in funding, drop-off in support for students. I had a dual appointment in engineering as well as chemistry. And I moved to Research Park to be head of the analytical part of this NSF-funded center to do fire toxicology.
This is all in Utah?
All in Utah. And so the logic behind that is that people were fighting fires as if nothing had changed in home environments and industrial environments and mm-hmm. so on. And so the advent of plastics, let's say plastics especially, all kinds of things would be generated in a fire that didn't exist in the handbooks of how you fight fire.
Mm-hmm.
If it's only wood and brick and mortar and,
yeah.
and those kinds of things, ventilating and so on is a good answer. But the concept was find out what's really there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got involved in mock experiments and so on. NIST was part of this, and so they had whole rooms that they set afire with all kinds of things in them and so on. The university-supported labs were far smaller. They had pyrolysis boxes and things mm-hmm. like that. So we got into pyrolysis mass spectrometry and we learned, I guess is a better word, some of the radiation chemistry things
mm-hmm.
to understand what's going on. GCMS was the sort of the order of the day
mm-hmm.
For doing that. And systems were now computerized. But there were, I think, four centers in the U.S. I don't remember where the others were, but I will never forget the first meeting where we were showing our wares, what we had done and what we had learned and mm-hmm. so on. And of course, the computer would give you a probability when you assign the
people. Yeah.
And so it would say, I don't know, 80% probability, whatever it is, and 40% and so on. So most of our colleagues came from more of an engineering background. We had medical school people, a toxicologist, medical persons, myself heading the analytical part of the operation. And so we were approaching it from a different dimension. So the sort of engineering knowledge had maybe four peaks in the chromatogram were labeled as the same compound. They simply added them up and put them into the analytical table, reporting their discoveries. And we said, excuse me,
mm-hmm.
no, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we told them capillary columns would be better, and so, did all kinds of things that complicated their lives and kept us in the lead of some of those things. We did a key experiment for NASA in terms of a plastic that was going to be a lining of I think the space shuttle, I'm
mm-hmm.
not sure, but certainly something was going to be sent into space. And they sent it to us to examine what happened in the case of a fire, because by this time we had had fires.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And we had cooked people mm-hmm. in plastics and so on. So anyhow, our approach more or less was to have a chamber in which we control the temperature and pyrolyze stuff. And we have rats in an animal model that were inhaling the fumes mm-hmm. from this. We had little tubes and masks on them, so they got dosed with whatever was in there. And then we were sucking off, sampling, and doing analytical chemistry on another piece
mm-hmm.
of whatever was going on. And so anyhow, one of the mice had an absolutely characteristic brain wave, was having a grand mal seizure.
Oh my.
Okay. Well, find out what that is, okay?
Yeah.
So we actually did that. We did a GCMS experiment with a mouse as a parallel detector hooked to EKG.
So this was to coordinate his seizure with whatever was coming, out of the... Wow.
Sure. And we nailed it. I don't remember the compound anymore. But it was... we certainly saved anyone who was exposed to that by that being ripped out and deleted as a potential plastic.
Yeah, yeah.
And we gave the NIH Medical Society a drug that they can use to study grand mal seizure in animals. So anyhow, there were interesting analytical kinds of things
serendipitous
that we did and that. And I got involved in artificial heart projects and other things, artificial eye. So all kinds of experiments where a little bit of knowledge of physics and chemistry and mass spectrometry can significantly affect biomedical kinds of experiments. And so, you know, getting a dual appointment and license to wear a gown and walk through some of those rooms, I changed the protocol on laser lung surgery. After they ignited a patient in the sixth experiment, and I did a protocol simulation with liver and oxygen and a hood, and I had ignition success every time with my crude manipulation of a surgical probe. So that never entered the clinical practice. And the unfortunate patient had signed all the appropriate documents. It's a risky procedure, not approved, etc., etc. So all kinds of things were happening, and then I decided I was ready to be something like a department head. It actually came to a head by my wife, who had gone through medical school training, trying to get an academic appointment at the University of Utah. And we were told basically no. She was a clinic. I had a clinical appointment and was doing some great experiments.
So this is in addition to your appointment in the chemistry department?
Yes.
So you had this dual situation where you got a... Okay.
Sure. So I had then chemistry, medicine, and engineering appointments.
Wow.
And my lab was no longer on the campus. And so I decided to sort of go back to my roots and go back to doing more fundamental experiments. Collision-induced dissociation, this time to understand from a very fundamental viewpoint how it works, and to do it for larger molecules. And that's where Anil Shukla comes into the picture, because I tried unsuccessfully to hire him twice as a postdoc.
A-N-I-L.
Kumar Shukla, S-H-U-K-L-A. And so I succeeded in hiring him as a postdoc to come to the University of Utah and help me reestablish my research on the main campus back in the Department of Chemistry.
So you kind of drifted off into another universe.
I had. And when I went there, they were hiring so many people, they were planning to expand into Research Park, where my research labs were located. But they never did, at least in terms of chemistry. And so I was an isolated example there. And so I insisted on coming back into the main chemistry building and back into the wing physical chemists were located and so on. And so I was sort of getting back into that and getting research grants to build a new mass spectrometer, having a double focusing first stage instrument to then collide in a molecular beam sense. With larger molecules and anything that we chose, actually, to look at the collision-induced dynamics. What are the scattering angles? What are the products? What are their translational energies? And so on. So a very fundamental study of collision-induced dynamics of the MS-MS tandem mass spectrometry experiment. And so we're going to use everything we had learned. I left out the story of cross-beam experiments. Marvin left behind the cross beam, and so we continued to do cross beam experiments. That's where Yuan T. Lee was helped to us. He stopped for a week to talk about it. We were helped to him because we had read his papers on how to build supersonic jets. And they didn't have all the details, so Marvin and I built it our way for half of it and his way for the other half. when he saw it, he said, man, that's a good idea. Mm. And so it's something we had learned from photochemistry. I guess I had learned it. If you shine light, then you don't want your light to bounce back. You build a cone. I've forgotten what it's called. Some fancy name on it, but it bounces light back and forth, and so it never gets back into the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
So for our purposes, we simply build a hole in the opposite end of the chamber big enough to put a pump.
Mm-hmm.
That scales down the size of your vacuum chamber pumping requirements by almost 2 powers of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had small vacuum chambers, actually a bell jar. We belted out of surplus parts and gift spectrometers and so on.
Mm-hmm.
In Marvin's graduate school experience, later added more sophisticated things to it. But it was in an ordinary bell jar. So later we had to put in safety shields and all kinds of stuff and improved upon it. But that was a starting point, taught us all we needed to do to turn it up a notch and mm-hmm. go to higher molecular weight species.
Mm.
Because the whole interest in mass spectrometry was shifting, had shifted. By then it had definitely shifted. Higher molecular weight molecules.
Where high was proteins?
No, it wasn't that high yet. It was sort of 100 or so molecular weight. And
that's the problem with high molecular weight. That's high.
Variable definition. Okay. And so we started out doing the electron impact ionization and so on. And within a few years, we had to move up to electrospray and all of that stuff. But Anil Shukla was the key person who joined me. And so we did the design, construction, all of that of this new generation tandem mass spectrometry at the University of Utah. And then the unwillingness of the medical school to consider my wife for an appointment created a rift that was couldn't be healed. So we worked together. So I then announced that I was up for grads. I was mm-hmm. willing to consider a move.
Mm-hmm.
We discovered there were very few places at the medical school and the academic school in the same campus. So that restricted our choice, but we were sort of jointly candidates for those places. And part of my interest in the University of Delaware was that it did not have a medical school, but it was so close to Hopkins, so close to New York City,
yeah.
so close to Penn,
yeah.
All of these things.
Yeah.
It was within easy commuting range, and
yeah.
so started a discussion with Dialogue. And essentially, Nancy gave up on me and left with a mentor of hers
mm-hmm.
with an MD degree.
Mm-hmm.
So I found my bank account and my joint stock account and my house emptied the furniture, those kinds of things. And so I became serious about looking for a job elsewhere
because
there were way too many ghosts. I didn't want to refill the house, refill the everything else. And so Utah tried to keep me to their enormous credit. They offered me the iron chair, which they would have created to keep me there.
Mm-hmm.
But enough people, younger people had been hired. I'd been involved in hiring a goodly number of them that were totally qualified to be department chair.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of ready to do something like this. I had to interview for jobs like this. To be interesting to a number of universities.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was ready to do that. And Delaware turned out to be the choice. And so moved across the country. Several interesting experiences. I took my first round of Chinese students with me and developed a connection with China that proved interesting later on. Moved lock, stock, and barrel across the country. We were going to move in the caravan. I guess we had 2 moving trucks and 4 cars that were driving together across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Because the agreement we had with the university that the moving truck could load everything, loaded over the weekend, fell apart. The university police would not let us steal the truckload of equipment from the university. I had to call university vice presidents and get them released. It took me 3 or 4 hours after my students, other people had left. We never met each other until we got to Delaware. I got there first. Mm. And I picked up 2 speeding tickets crossing the country, trying to catch up with them. And one of the moving trucks turned over in the Pennsylvania Turnpike and destroyed the tandem mass spectrometer that we had built.
Mm.
Fully insured, but then how do you value
something
that's home built?
Yeah.
And so on.
And worked.
And worked and all of this stuff. And so it was a serious delay of getting research going again.
So what year would this be?
So let me see. 1986 is when I accepted the job and set this thing in motion. I showed up in September of 1987.
Okay.
1987. So there are all sorts of things I discovered about the University of Delaware that were new. I discovered, they're supposed to take my stuff to a loading dock. There was no loading dock. They didn't have a place to receive heavy equipment and do the kinds of things a modern university has to do. I had negotiated as part of my agreement to go there that the number one building priority for the university campus was a new building for chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that meant there would be a new building for chemistry. And so I got there, I discovered that not only was there no loading dock, but there were no doors wide enough to bring in stuff that needed to be done. And so we had to knock out walls and all kinds of stuff to get the instruments that were not broken. Install and start up again. So a long, difficult story to restart the research and It was about 2 years.
2 years.
About
yeah.
2 years to get everything up and going again. And Neil Shukla was absolutely key to helping that make that possible, actually. And so we got insurance funds. The university is a private school. Just as Cornell is. It's a state-assisted private university.
State-assisted?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the formal classification.
Okay.
And that meant approved for a new chemistry building meant you got to meet the development officer and raise the money to build a new building for the chemistry department. So I got to do that. and that was a successful enterprise. I also had, as part of my dowry, I think it was $5 million from the endowment that I could use for starter grants and things like this to hire new faculty and make things happen. I got 6 slots to build up the technical services, so to build up the machine shop, electronic shop, glass shop, and now a computer support facility. Mm-hmm. Which was needed at a Research One university. And I think I had 6 faculty slots that I could recruit toward. And there were 6 persons who were non-tenured assistant professors. So this became 12 faculty slots as things played out. And so anyhow, I had sort of the basics to build a department.
So what kind of department did you have prior to your arrival?
Well, I told the department that this was their 3rd try to become a distinguished research university.
Mm-hmm.
When Delaware was really set up in the sort of immediate, I'll say, wartime and post-wartime period, as a graduate university, DuPont Company sent senior people to be chairman of chemistry and of chemical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sort of funded to launch these departments.
Mm-hmm.
And chemical engineering was extremely successful.
This is because DuPont, owned Delaware. And
sure. It was DuPont country.
Wanted to make it.
And wanted it to make happen, but the person they sent knew the kind of people that you had to hire and so on and so forth. And the chemistry guy sort of feathered his own nest and hired people who wanted to do similar things. I'm exaggerating. I don't know why it went wrong, but anyhow, one was a very successful trajectory. Mm-hmm. The other one was not. And so it was not a failure, but it was not a hugely successful. It was one that had some good people, some really good people. And that was essentially the story after I got there. They then hired another person coming in with very good academic credentials. And so you do it all over again and see if it works.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure why. He hired some very, very good people, but they kept several who shouldn't have been kept.
Mm.
And, again, to go back to Dean Kenneth Pitzer, when I let it be known I was going to the University of Delaware, he invited me to come visit him in Berkeley
mm-hmm.
and have a chat
mm-hmm.
about how you do this.
Mm-hmm.
And we had had a few conversations before, but this time it was very serious.
Mm-hmm.
He says, he gave me names of people. He said, these are first-class people. And so they should have more say in how the department is run
mm-hmm.
Than others. And so you've got to be absolutely brutal, make it perfectly clear what your expectations are.
Mm-hmm.
And if they meet those expectations, great. If they fail to meet those expectations, well, it didn't work, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, it didn't work. And so that's absolutely what you have to do to either build or preserve a good or first-class research institution, whether it be a university or some other kind. And so I knew what had to be done. And the fact that Burnaby Munson was there,
mm-hmm.
the fact that Douglas Ridge was there, meant mass spectrometry already had a very significant footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't need me to be in the laboratory all the time coaching students
mm-hmm.
who needed help and so on. There were resource people immediately available to talk to about mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
Neither of them were funded very well. And so I imagined that I could help with that, and that turned out to be true. And the labs need to be re-equipped and so on, and so we did all of those things.
Munson had a connection to the Humboldt Oil and Refining
sure.
outfit. Were you there with him at the
no.
same time?
No, he was the person hired to replace me.
Ah, okay.
And he got to do the experiments, and I didn't get to do.
No.
and so I met him as my replacement and so on. And when Burnaby came to the University of Delaware, his first graduate students, I thought was quite interesting, John McNovitz, who went over have an industrial career, and I think it, well, not sure where it was, Hewlett Packard maybe?
Anyway, could be.
We could find his name easily enough, but when he was a graduate student, he called up to get my advice on building a better chemical ionization source.
Uh-huh.
So working with the patent owner and founder of chemical ionization, I treasured that phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And I was happy to mm-hmm. help out with it. And they had invited me a couple of times to give talks at University of Delaware and so on. And so there's several positive aspects of going there. And it turned out to be a wonderful move
mm-hmm.
in all kinds of dimensions. Among other things, I met Anne at a faculty meeting, my wife, whom you know,
mm-hmm.
and it really was love at first sight and has never changed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I immediately got over my nasty divorce.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't out of the woods financially
mm-hmm.
by any means. And so part of our story is she picked me up out of the gutter because my net worth was about minus $100,000, that is. but I had a reasonable income and a brand new house.
Mm-hmm.
And so Anne saw possibilities for hanging her art, and
uh-huh.
And she did. And, And so I have. It was a wonderful career because my being first in line in the development office meant I had license to raise money.
Mm.
And so I had to talk to people who have money.
Yeah, sure.
And so I got connected to them. I had to talk to federal agencies about matching grants and all kinds of things for instrumentation, etc. I got to testify to the General Assembly on the need for buildings and so on.
This for the state?
For the state. And the reason for that. And so we were beautifully successful. And so the Lamont DuPont building, I learned, one of the rules I learned in the development office, you probably know this, but if you're going to ask for money, you have to give money. And so if you go to the University of Delaware, to the Lamont DuPont Laboratory, first one named for Lamont DuPont, Lamont DuPont was the one who moved the DuPont company from TNT to nitroglycerin and modern explosives. He had studied with, guess who, Alfred Nobel. So bringing that technology to the DuPont company was done by Lamont DuPont. It seemed to me that kicking the DuPont company in the posterior to modernize how they did explosives was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were the first to honor him by the Lamont DuPont Laboratory. They also brought some sizable checks, one of which came to me personally for $2 million.
Hmm.
And after a few microseconds of thought, I decided to endorse it to the university and drive on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could have wiped out personal debts very quickly, but
mm-hmm.
would not have been a good thing. And my father told me it was too honest
mm-hmm.
for me to do anything like that. So anyhow, it was a very successful fundraise, exercise, got to know people. And so if you come to the entryway of this, you'll find the list of donors, Dr. and Mrs. Jean Futrell,
mm-hmm.
and the bronze plaque in the front of the DuPont Laboratory. And if you go to the oldest, you go to the Art Museum, there's a big brick walkway leading to the University Museum,
mm-hmm.
and the bricks have names of donors, and so you find Jean H. Futrell and Ann Crone Graham
mm-hmm.
bricks.
Mm-hmm.
If you look very carefully, mm-hmm. they're still there. We checked it out.
No good.
Bricks are still in place.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to give some money before you ask for money, and so we got involved with lots and lots of people, influential sources. I became conversant with all the funding agencies. By this time, I'd already been president of the American Society for Mass Spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
You were one of my officers, Greg, Mike.
I'd have to, I guess
I think,
so.
Everything
is, I was at that 2-year term, and of course, you guys got stretched over this huge
mine was a 6-year term.
Yeah.
I'm almost certain that we were in one of those offices.
I've got the data back
there. Either that or you were staffing the poster session
when I came up
with that creation.
Yeah.
In those days, we had the Henry Rosenstocks and the big shots do all the posters
to
get people to recognize what an important medium it is for communication. So anyhow, my new professional society thing I got involved with was the Council for Chemical Research.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one that has, you have to be a department head in chemistry or chemical engineering to be an academic member. You have to be the director of chemical research or close equivalent if you represent a government laboratory or an industrial laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the industry, government, university coalition and teaming.
Mm-hmm.
That's been a theme we've come back to. You know, that's a very, very powerful approach to things.
Mm-hmm.
And if I look back at all the toys I made, I realize that if I had partnered with an instrument company on any number, well, not all, but some versions of these toys that I made for doing my fundamental research studies. Mm-hmm. If I had done this, then these would have become items of commerce. Mm-hmm. At least I think so. Mm-hmm. So that's what I tell myself, that they would have. And my PhD student, who's so distinguished, Richard Smith, mm-hmm. has more patents, more industry collaborations than any other scientist in Battelle worldwide. Mm-hmm. So that's the worldwide Battelle. Mm-hmm. And let's see, I guess we stand at something like 65,000 degree-holding scientists and engineers now, mm-hmm. at Battelle. Mm-hmm. Huge organization, mm-hmm. internationally, compared to the 6,000 that we have here at PNNL. And so that's something he did and I never did. I do have several patents along the way. And if they had been prosecuted seriously, they might turn out to have been interesting. Anyhow, that was
missing. So PNNL is what, Pacific Northwest National
Laboratory? Yes, Pacific Northwest National Laboratory.
Okay. And so you say that, well, I mean, I don't want to get ahead of the story, but
yeah, sure.
There's about 6,000 people in that environment.
So it's very large. And a part of PNNL that we come to shortly is my going there as the first director coming from the national search to a new physical sciences facility for the molecular sciences, the Environmental Molecular Sciences Laboratory. Mm-hmm. But to kind of close on this, I never got involved in that dimension, but the fact that I didn't patent these ideas meant I was a consultant to virtually every instrument company there was.
Yeah.
Nationally, I didn't get involved in Japan. But I actually was on the inside track with so many commercial developments that was fun. That's part of the story. Excuse me, I need some water.
You probably need to take a water break. Yeah.